Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Pro Wrestling Interviews. This is Dr. John Stamey, live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We are so glad to be here tonight. The Amazing Velvet has a hall pass because he's a sick boy tonight, and he wanted to stay home and rest. So tonight we have as our host the great Susan Green, absolutely one of the greatest wrestlers in history. And Susan, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Good to be out here and enjoying the weather and getting to work out again.
Well, that's good. I'm sure you are. Well, we are thrilled to have you here as our one of our co-hosts. We have Stellar Steven from Richmond, Virginia. Steven, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great. I did an open mat earlier, so got some practice in and went to a competition yesterday, so plenty to talk about tonight with Sinister.
Well, that's great. Well, we're glad to have you here along with Susan Green, so we cannot have a better panel of experts here to talk about wrestling. And tonight, we are extremely lucky to have the one and only Sinister as our guest of honor. Sinister, how are you doing tonight, buddy? It's so good to have you here as our guest of honor.
I'm doing great, man. I'm honored to be here.
Well, we are glad to have you here. All right, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do like a good host. I'm going to turn this meeting over to the one and only Susan Green. Susan, take it away.
Okay, well, Steve, you had a competition this past weekend or weekend before last?
Went to a Fuji event recently and in Midlothian, and it was pretty great. My school did pretty well. We were third in, I think, total score. And one of the other schools from the Richmond, Virginia area, Mongrel, saw one of the female competitors do some no-gi fights, and she did well in those, won by armbar. And then, I think one of the leading point winners, earners, actually, was someone from my school, John, who's a blue belt. So it was a pretty great event. I kind of was there all day, just in the morning with kids, and then afternoon it was like white belts, adults, and that kind of ended around 4. So got some good photos and videos to put up later, and got some group. Got a nice group photo so after the event. So, and went to the local ranch bar after. So it was a pretty fun day.
Okay. The Sinister, you said your MMA fight got canceled, and they ain't really got you another date, have they?
No, they haven't got me another date yet. But my instructor, he's always, looking for fights like up in Atlanta area. And usually he'll find one. It'll be like probably 2 months down the road. And we used to get prepared for that one. It just, here in Augusta, it's kind of tough to get an event going because, that's just the way it's always been.
Susan, this is Dr. John. I've got a question for you. What are we going to do about this COVID thing? This is really going to start hurting events again, don't you think?
Oh, yes. People have just got to learn that when there's a holiday, you've got to stay masked up. Or, even the people that had the shots, they're saying we need a booster now. Here they're sitting there saying mandatory mask. I know the city manager said that mandatory for all city employees. that was a shock because he went over the governor. The governor said they didn't have to, and the university had a big fight about they weren't going to have to wear a mask, and then they were going to have to wear a mask, and then I sat there and said, I'm glad I'm not in the university. No, I'll wear a mask, but I'd hate to sit there and go to a class and somebody have an argument because of a mask.
Right.
But, yeah. It's, I think the safe thing to do right now is the mask.
I think WWE are acquiring it too, I think at SummerSlam and events coming up. So I guess it depends on which state you're in and what the rules are in each state.
Yeah.
You know, that brings me another thing. With that, you know, if people would stop going back and forth about this conspiracy theory about the mask and the government putting stuff in the injections, the vaccine, all they have to do is they would just, like, wear the mask until this thing dies down, then everything get back to normal. But you're going to have people out there that, like you think, they're going to be arguing back and forth about this mask situation. And
I think events will probably start enforcing the vaccination rule. I think SummerSlam might be one of those events, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
I did have a question for Sinister. Did you try out a power plant? I also heard that Chael Sonnen tried out once years ago.
Yeah, I did. I tried out for the power plant, I want to say back in 98. And it wasn't what everybody thought it would be because it is tough. And the three trainers I had there, one of the late great Pistol Pants Watley, Mike Warner, and Hart Body Leverage. And, you know, they usually would get like 25 guys to come in a group, and they would just run you through all these drills, trying to see who they can weed out, who's going to quit, and who's going to stay. And it was tough. And, you know, it's sad that the WCW went under and the power plant went out of business. But it was a good learning experience. And I met a lot of people. You know, some were good people. Some, well, you know, they were who they were. But the power plant, one thing I learned from the power plant is you have to keep yourself in shape. And I don't mean just lifting weights. I mean, cardio, the whole nine yards, just having good endurance, having good stamina, and you also have to have good ring knowledge. Know where you are in the ring, what to do and what not to do. And it was a bit learning experience, but it was like boot camp. So it was something different. I just say that's one of the hardest things I had to do in my life.
Yeah, that does sound like it. I've heard similar stories about the cardio drills, and listening to Chael talk about it on video and reading some thoughts about it. And he had it was like after I think it was when he was in college, and Sarge Buddy Lee Parker was there.
Right.
When he was at the power plant. So, did you meet Bobby Eaton around that time at any point or sometime after?
No, because when I got there, Bobby Eaton, I think he was heading up the road to, I think, USWA or Smoky Mountain Wrestling. It was one of those two. And I didn't get to meet him. But I did get to meet Jim Cornette at the time, and he's a character.
Yeah,
he's a real character. No, but I actually met Goldberg when he had hair. And that was a strange individual at that time. But, you know, they made him out to be a star, so, you know, he made it. And I don't know if you remember Lash LaRue, the Raging Cajun.
Yeah.
Yeah, me and him same clan. Yeah. Yeah, so he made it out of our group, you know, to sign a contract. And I don't know where he is right now. I think he's still doing the independent team, but he was definitely a good athlete. So I met quite a few people. Yeah.
Yeah, I read that Lash retired in 06, but if anybody knows more, please hit me up on that. But, so you said 98, so that must have been an interesting year to be at the power plant too. During that Monday Night Wars area.
Yeah, it was. We had fun times. The only bad thing about it is when they had these ideas for the NWO. That was, you know, they had those ideas before I came. But when they started putting up the posters in the gym, that's when they started cutting out the little guys. And when I mean my little guys, I mean guys like me that was trying to, you know, get up into the main event, trying to get up into the TV event. Because mostly guys, we was doing dark matches. And when you had Hogan, Nash, Hall, and people from the WWF or at the time I think it was WWF, if I ain't mistaken. They was coming from the WWF over to WCW. They started making a lot of cuts because these guys were getting money like you wouldn't believe. So in order to stay afloat, you know, they had to make those cuts, which I can understand because, you know, that's business. But
just recently WWE made a bunch of cuts to NXT, and it feels like they're going in a new direction, is what I've been reading, about doing a youth push. And they're releasing all these great talents that are in their 30s and 40s, like Bobby Fish. And interesting times, because that just means more talent for AEW or Impact, Ring of Honor. So it's going to be interesting to see where people end up. But you mentioned dark matches. I wanted to ask you, how do you feel about AEW kind of using this outside talent and putting them on their YouTube show? Like, should dark matches not be on YouTube, or is it an okay idea?
Well, to be honest with you, in a way, it's kind of a good thing because that do give the lower, you know, I don't like saying lower class, but the lower ranked guys a little exposure. Because back when I did it, the only exposure you got is if people came to the event and, you know, if they paid attention to you while you were doing dark matches, that was the only exposure you got. But now, you know, you got it on YouTube, you got all this social media out here where, you know, people getting more and more exposure now. The only problem I have with that is you have, and I hate to say it, but you have some guys that come in the door that never been trained, but they'll lie to the training coaches, they'll lie to the promoters, say they've been trained, and they just make up some moves, and I guess people need the money, so they just put them on the card and try to make something out of them. Because I've seen better talent and independence than I have seen in some of these big league companies. And I'm trying to figure out how in the world did they make it on TV. But these guys over here, they're working independent and nobody's giving them a chance.
When I saw WWE that they was bringing in some awful big girls, Nia Jax big, but they had two girls that I don't remember their name, but they were bigger than Nia Jax. And I thought, they're going to another, they're going back to Bull Nakano and Jumbo. They were actually huge. And they weren't Japanese girls. So, I don't know where they found them or don't even, they just
know,
showed pictures of them.
I know Tamina Snuka is pretty big. She was tagging with Nia Jax at one point.
Yeah. Well, these girls are bigger than Nia Jax, the two that they, and it, they got, they're with two of the small girls, and I don't remember which ones they were. But it was like, I don't know what they're going to do with them, and I don't know what they can do. Because it... It sure didn't look like they're going to really be able to do a whole lot. Their look. But, the looks can be seized very easily. So.
And I did want to ask, Sinister, did you have, what's your MMA background like? Because we've heard you have done MMA, and obviously we know about your jiu-jitsu background and you being a brown belt, but can you go into what MMA training you've done?
Okay, you mean the training or the actual, like, fights?
Oh, fights and training, if you want to discuss.
Yeah, well, fight, record, like 3-2. And that's because, I'm still learning the aspects of the cage and how to use the cage to my advantage. But it's the MMA part in the cage, that's it's different because it's not like, okay, you're in the boxing ring, but you can move around, you can do, you can do things that you couldn't do it like in a boxing match or a collegiate wrestling match.
Yeah.
Except gouging the eyes and throwing shots. And if you know how to use the things to your advantage and get away from a good striker, you'll be okay. My thing is the groundwork. I'm more comfortable on the ground than trying to do stand up and, swing, trade punches with people all day long. So that's one of the experiences and things I learned from the cage. Now, as far as jiu-jitsu, I love jiu-jitsu because 9 times out of 10, a lot of fights in the street is going to end up on the ground. A lot of people say that's not true, but I've seen it happen 1,000 times. And working in a nightclub as a bouncer, every fight I've seen ended up on the ground, both men and women.
Mm-hmm.
But, just a lot of them, when they get there, they really don't know what they do when they're on the ground. They just, what they call loving on each other. Trying to hug and see who can get to their feet first. Yeah, but the,
just recently, not too long ago, I was looking at videos on YouTube as I was, I've been doing it more lately or recently. There was a blue belt that took a thief down in the street, and he didn't even have to strike him. He just had a takedown and just was able to hold him until somebody came to help or whatever. And it was pretty interesting, seeing it on a live video, a real street fight situation, no strikes involved.
Exactly. Just trying to hold the person until the police get there or just hold them until they calm down.
Right.
Yeah. And, to be honest with you, jiu-jitsu or wrestling is it's basically the same if people really look at it. Because if you look at the top wrist lock this lock is the same thing in jiu-jitsu as the Americana. A lot of people don't know that, but it really is. It's the same technique. You have the same throws. You have leg locks. You have wrist locks. You have arm bars. You name it, chokes. And over the years, I've been looking at both sides, and it's a lot involved in jiu-jitsu that you see in pro wrestling and vice versa. And, you know, that's why I like it so much. So when I'm doing jiu-jitsu, I also feel like I'm training for a pro wrestling match. And when I'm training for a pro wrestling match, I feel like I'm also helping myself with my jiu-jitsu skills. And it's really, you know, it's really a learning experience. It's very educational.
Well, I know when I was trained by Joe Blanchard, he actually showed me there was two ways to put the top wrist lock on. And if you put it on one way, you got your forearm. If your opponent's talking, you can jab them under the chin with your forearm or your elbow.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're lucky enough, or if they're unlucky enough, I should say, they'll bite their tongue. Or they'll learn to quit jawing their mouth if they're in the ring. But he showed me a lot of reversals that would make whoever I was wrestling keep their mouth shut.
Oh, yeah.
Which I guess that's what a lot of people don't understand. I wasn't trained by Mula. I was trained by Joe Blanchard out in Texas, and I'd wrestled almost 3 years before I became one of them. And she never trained me. I paid her to train me, but I went on the road the Monday after I put my mother on the plane Sunday. And she was shocked that I come driving back with my car. And I said to her, because she didn't want the girls to have cars, and I said, well, that's my car. I got it for graduation. You know, she just drove out here to help me get out here and get me set up. So she was, What'd you say?
You said that was your mom that helped you, went out there and helped you got set up?
Yeah, my mom drove out with me because I'd never been out of the state of Texas at 16 years old. I graduated at 16, and I was coming out here 5 days after I graduated. You know, I graduated May 31st, and I was at Lillian Ellisor School of Girl Wrestling on June the 5th. I was in Savannah, Georgia. Well, my mother was here for 4 days. We got here on a Wednesday, and she flew out on Sunday, and I was in Savannah, Georgia, Monday. You know, she watched me work out one time, and she said, I can put you on the road.
That must have been
And believe it or not, guys, I did not train like the average, you know, being started in the 69s. When I started, we beat the crap out of each other, and the better girl won. We weren't told. Promoter would say to go, y'all to stay out there for at least 10 minutes. Well, when you heard 10 minutes and you saw two cat fights, when I was 15 years old, I was the kitten. I got the crap beat out of me. Because I was wrestling Barbara Glenn, Kay Noble. You know, and if you don't think Kay Noble can knock your lights out. Mae Young beat the car. My brother drove me out. I couldn't even drive. I had a wrestling license, but I couldn't drive a car. Because my parents had to go before Governor Conley to assure them that I was not wrestling for child labor. So he let them give me a license to wrestle. And my brother drove me to Phoenix, Arizona to wrestle Mae Young. And that woman threw me every which way but loose because I had a fingerprint everywhere she touched me, and I was black and blue all over my body. One time when I was wrestling Barbara Galento, Joe sat there and said, you know, you always had to run in swimming and tennis. And I said, yes, sir, I'm still running. And he says, when you train over here, you have to run that 5 miles. Whenever you hear them say 10 minutes, you only got 5 minutes left. I know you can outrun them. So if they wanted a Broadway, did me to run the last 5 minutes and not let them catch me. You know, I'd get in and out of the ring. After I saw the ladies, they said, "Why were you running?" And I said, "Because Joe told me to." But he wouldn't tell me that we were going Broadway. He'd just tell me not to let him catch me. You know, so, and I jumped over the top rope down to the floor, and I jumped over the top rope to get in the ring, and I could get in and out faster than they could. So, and then I said, normally they'd say 12 minutes, and the referee would say, "Well, you better start running." But they never told me it was a Broadway. You know, I just had to run however long I had to run and stay away from them, and if they caught me, get to the ropes. You know, and I said, you know, and then, believe it or not, Nuala did not spark me yet. I'm sitting in the dressing room telling Peggy Patterson, "You got to get in another dressing room. It's not right that we're dressing together." And she said, "We always dress together." And I said, "No, we don't. I never dressed in the same dressing room with the woman that I fought when I started." That's how tight Joe Blanchard trained.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, I wrestled some of the great old-timers. Talked to June Byers. I worked with her. I actually worked with her training, doing some chain wrestling whenever I worked for her. And she actually put her NWA belt on me when I went to Mexico and Japan for her. And when they told me I was going to drop it, I said, "Well, Sam Mushnick didn't say I was supposed to drop it," and he was the president of the NWA. And Nelda Brooks didn't know me I was supposed to do it, so no disrespect to y'all, but shoot your best shot, because Sam had asked Mildred, did she think I could handle it, because the women, it was a shoot. If you could take the belt, then you own the belt. And Mildred was the NWA champion for the West Coast. June Garz was the Central States, because she was located out of Houston. And I don't know who had, because Mueller's belt was not the NWA belt. Her belt, she had it made. It had her name on it, and she won it in Baltimore. And she actually beat Betty Clark with a best belt in Baltimore. So it was a rig, because Mula had the belt name, her name on the belt. If you look at it whenever you're ever out in Wichita Falls at the PWHF Hall of Fame, it's got her name on it and the date she won it and the city she won it in. But there is a third belt somewhere in this country that has NWA and has the date they put it on the person, but the one for Mildred Burke was in 1948. And I wrestled Jumbo and Blue Nakano and Jackie Sutto, and I said, "It's no disrespect for y'all, but you're going to have to take it if you want it." And then Lola Gonzalez and them down in Mexico. It's one that they didn't try. I came away with me a busted mouth, but I was lucky enough to have Danny Hodge and Larry Sharp and Barry Funk and a bunch of the other guys that did shooting. Bobby Shane showed me a lot of stuff. Mildred Burke showed me a lot of stuff on how to hook and shoot. And whenever I actually took Mula's belt in Dallas, and then she didn't show up for the rest of the matches. You know, that's a funny story. She shouldn't have. I'd have went along.
Well, Susan, can you blame her? Can you blame her for not showing up for the rest of them?
No.
I mean, seriously.
I'm
sorry. That's right. She knew what time it was in Dallas. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, back to you.
She didn't even come to the dressing room. But you know, when I was in Savannah, Georgia, I said, Charlie Smith, the referee, walked by and said, "Baby over." And I'm looking like, what? And Peggy Patterson said, "You're going to win." And I said, "How does he know I'm going to win?" "Because you are." And I thought, Well, you're a whole lot bigger than me. I'm 128 pounds and you're 190. How does he know? And he's like, well, because he said baby over. And that's who smartened me up. I worked for 2.5 years, almost 3 years. I started on August 13th of 69. I got to Millis June the 5th of 71, and then 4 days later, I'm in the in a ring. And Charlie Smith says, baby face over. Or he says, baby over. And I thought, who the hell's a baby? I knew I was because I was younger than Peggy. But I thought, how did he know? Lynn knew that I wasn't smart. So I don't know what she thought, you know, if I was going to get out there and beat the crap out of, or try to beat the crap out of Peggy. But when I first started, I took a beating. In my junior year, the principal sat there and said, you know, if you miss a day of school, you'll be suspended. So whether I was on crutches or had my tape, shoulder tape or knee bandage, and my tennis coach and my swimming coach, it didn't matter. I still had to do the workouts with that because I was in high school.
Yep. And, you know, that's what amazes me because, like you're saying, the era that you came from was the way you had to train. And, you know, y'all actually trained just like the men did. And why the matches is so doggone good. And it's a difference today because, like, when I look at it today with the newer people, and, you know, I'm not teaching the women of the day, but it's just like, in that era, everybody had their own style, but like today, it's like everybody's the same, and like it's hard to determine, okay, who from who, and who's gonna do something different because it's just like they get in the ring, it's like the same outfit, it's the same, you know, it's not the technical moves that you were taught. It's like more high flying stuff.
Oh yeah. Who's going to be the best acrobat, you know. I couldn't do what they did, but they couldn't do what I did. They wouldn't be able to take the pounding. They would drop out in the training before because, as I said, Joe Blanchard sit there and told me, and I call him Bob, became Blackjack Mulligan. We had to run 5 miles under 30 minutes. We had to run 5 miles after 8 hours of training. And we were in a tin building in South Texas. With no, he wouldn't pull the, it was an old warehouse. He wouldn't pull the doors open for us to get any wind going through there. There was no fans when we were training. And he's sitting there telling me I need to put on weight because I was 98 pounds when I started. My first batch, I was 112. You know, so I thought I'd really done a good job. I was 14 pounds heavier than I started. Bob had lost weight, you know, and I sit there and I said, we were throwing drop kicks, and Bobby Shane is the one that taught me how to do drop kicks, and well, Bob too, and head scissors. And then someone sat there and said, Robert Gibson, because I took Robert Gibson's head scissors, and I said, no, he took mine because I got it from Bobby Shane, and I started before him. See me as much as you saw Robert, but he saw me do it in Alabama.
Exactly.
So, and a lot of people didn't see us because we were in a territory for 1 or 2 weeks and we moved on. And Roy Shires would keep us there 3 weeks up in San Francisco. And I said, we felt like we had a real home. In a hotel room, but we had a real home.
I have a question since you mentioned that. How temporary could you be during those times? Because, like, now, sometimes they'll lock you into long contracts if they want, if they can get you through. But lately, they've been releasing a lot of talent. So do you think working for one group should be very temporary? And I'm sure it had to have been more temporary back then.
With the females back in the 60s, and 70s and part of the 80s, if you didn't work for Mula, you didn't work in the United States. Or you worked
right.
just the general area. The Sheik had Detroit, and he trained his girls, and they used those, which was Heather Feather and June Byers. Not June Byers. Mary Jane Mull. You know, but there was four girls that he had trained, and they worked the area. And I sit there and said, then whenever you would go over to the Goggle in Kansas, he had Gina Antone and Betty Nicolai and a couple other girls, Sandy Pardlow, and he worked them. So they worked the general area. And in South Texas, Fritz von Erich and Joe Blanchard did not use Mueller's girls until I became one of Mueller's girls. They would rather bring them out of Kansas or use the ones that Dory and Terry Funk had up in Amarillo. Yeah. And mainly it was they could drive down and, you know, they didn't have to fly them in. And back in my day, you know, I left South Carolina, Columbia, and I had 3 days to get to San Francisco because on the third day, I had to be getting Sandy Parker and Tony Rose at the San Francisco airport because they was flying in from Australia for us to be there 3 weeks. And, of course, when the doctor saw me, he said, I'll get your physical tomorrow. I sat there and said, well, I'm 16 years old. And he says, you need to sleep. I said, I was getting out trying to pick my car up, just trying to keep the adrenaline going to be able to get drove through because Donna didn't drive. I was the only driver, and I had 72 hours to get to San Francisco from South Carolina.
And so, you did, right?
And I did.
San Francisco.
Yeah. Well, but the speed limit was 70 miles an hour, so I could travel a little faster.
Making those towns.
Yeah.
What did you do? Use Interstate 40 all the way, or what?
Shoot, no. Interstate 20 stopped at Thompson, Georgia, and then it was two-lane roads until you got to Alabama. Then you got a little bit. Actually, you had two-lane road going through Birmingham. Then just outside of Birmingham, you got back on Interstate 20.
Hey, sorry if I'm interrupting.
Yeah,
I wanted to ask Sinister, since we're talking about traveling. Did you have any good riding partners over the years in wrestling or in training?
Well, my trainer, the recent trainer, Mike Ellison, me and him, you know, rode a few places together, and a few independent guys, but it was a lot of them that I didn't ride with because I know everybody's different, but how can I put it? When you traveling the roads and you have police out there, you know, roaming around, there's just some things that you shouldn't do on the road that's going to keep their attention.
Yeah, you got to be careful.
Yeah, and some guys I'm just too afraid to ride with because I may not make it back. So
yeah.
Now when I get to where I go by myself.
Yeah, you were talking about wrist locks earlier. I got caught by one of my coaches recently. Or it was pretty funny. I was holding on, like he was going easy, not putting all full pressure. So I was just selling it, like I was in a pro wrestling hold. It was funny, but I did want to ask you, Sinister, do you watch any of the major MMA leagues, like ONE, Bellator, or UFC, that are televised?
Yeah, I watch UFC. I watch Bellator, you know, from time to time, especially the rerun. And my favorite that I like watching the old UFC when it first started because, you know, I learned a lot of techniques from that era and the stuff I see today, which today the stuff, you know, a lot of the techniques are very good. But it's just like, you know, I said before, back then, style was different. And each style, you could see how they would, it was like a game of chess. They would give a move to take a move or take a move to give a move. And
yeah.
UFC, that's what they turned into today. But it's just, today, I don't think it was as hard as it is today like it was back then, because when they first started, like, for example, if you was a fighter when
the Gracie era,
the Gracie era, you would have probably, you probably have to fight five times in one night. And that's
right.
That's a lot of fighting for one person.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, you guys only fight one fight, and that's probably like 10, 15 minutes. And, I mean, back then, those guys was, like, putting in the work. I mean, if you was the champion, you had a bullseye on your back. You had no choice but to stay on your game and stay on your training regimen, because they was coming after you. And,
yeah,
today,
I feel like...
Yeah, go ahead. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
I do. No, you're good. I was going to say, I do like going back and watching that, those original... early UFC shows and clips. It was definitely like a showcase for the Gracies. I know they were kind of behind. They're kind of trying to market their jiu-jitsu style, and it was definitely pretty new to some of these fighters, and it was definitely less worlds back then, but it, you know, Hoist was able to beat a lot of guys, and it was pretty amazing seeing him beat Dan Severn, get him in that I think it was a triangle, and tap Dan out, who was much bigger than him. And Ken Shamrock was kind of a threat. He had him in one fight where he kind of held him in guard the whole fight. Wasn't the most exciting, but when you think about it with the context, like, being able to hold someone like Hoist in one position is pretty impressive. So, yeah, that early period is very interesting to watch back, for sure.
Yeah. Actually, me and Ken did a seminar together about 20 years ago here in Augusta on Fort Gordon. Yep. And that was that was very exciting. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
He's a real beast.
Oh yeah, I was watching him post some videos or pictures from Wrestling Hall of Fame that he was going in, and seeing him hanging out with Jerry Briscoe, and it was pretty cool. One of the Malenko brothers. He's pretty impressive, and one of my friends got to meet him years back, because I have a musician friend that played in Nevada, so it's pretty cool that somebody I knew got to, like, hang out with Ken at a residence and, you know, get a photo op with him and hear those stories. So I'm glad to hear that you did a seminar with Ken, so that's pretty awesome.
Oh yeah, he's a real nice guy. Yeah, down to earth. And I also like to say that the women's division today is also good. One of my favorites of all time has always been Cyborg, you know. And that's another one. I always liked her. Noons is good, too. I like Noons. I always liked Holly Holmes. I've never been too much of a Ronda Rousey fan.
Right.
Even when she got in WWE, I wasn't too fond of her. You know, it's just...
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, she's good, but it's just her... I don't know if
Is it attitude?
Yeah, because the reason why, because it's like you don't talk down on the people that's paying your paycheck. Like, when she told WWE Universe, the fans, that they're ungrateful and something else, he said. And I'm like, yeah, these people buy tickets to see you, and you gonna just come out and say this. And it wasn't
I think she tweeted something about the Bray Wyatt chants recently in Chicago, and she said the same people were chanting for "We Want Beach Balls" and something else. But I don't think the internet is one collective like unit. Like, there's going to be different crowds that have different reactions for what's going on. But I do agree with what you're saying, that you probably shouldn't show no gratitude to, you know, the customers, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, don't get me wrong,
unless you're working, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, I respect her for what she done in the Olympics and for what she done in the sport, but things you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't just throw at people, because the WWE, from what I understand, they took care of her. You know, like when the other girls had to get, I don't mean girls, but other women, when they had to get rental cars and drive to places, just like Miss Susan was saying, when she got in her car and she drove all the way back and forth from San Francisco, Ronda Rousey, they put her on the WWE private jet, the big plane, flew her anywhere she wanted to go, put her in the best hotel, and she only worked 3 days a week and got paid very well. So why say something like that?
Yeah, so you think maybe she's ungrateful for a deal that she had a pretty good deal?
Yeah, I think
she don't realize what kind of deal she got, because that
she was
kind of
like a Brock Lesnar
that contract. She wouldn't have got the contract, because they just knew she was going to beat that. And I told one of my friends that was betting $500 on her. I sat there and said, "Don't bet that $500, because that girl's a kickboxer from Australia."
So
what? I said, "The girl's a kickboxer." And he said, "What?" And I said, "Holly's going to knock the crap out of her with a roundhouse." And he sat there, and first round, bam, there she went down. And he says,
yep,
"I lost $500, and you told me not to bet it." And I sat there and said, because she never did take a hit to the head. She still can't take a hit to the head.
Nope.
So she's had with MMA since she went into pro wrestling. She hadn't won, just like Brock Lesnar. You know, he's still under contract with MMA. And he's not winning like he was when he was the monster in MMA.
The last fight I saw Brock do was Mark Hunt, and I think Brock might have failed a drug test for that. But he's not – it was weird because he was listed as on Raw roster on the website, and then now we don't know if he's – coming back to WWE, could be signing with another promotion. I'm wondering if he's going back to UFC or doing Bellator, because a lot of the older fighters go to Bellator. But it is interesting. I didn't know much about Holly Holm until after that fight with Ronda, and it was pretty brutal, like, loss for Ronda.
Okay.
For sure.
Yeah, I did a show over in Japan where they had the kickboxers and all that, and Holly was there, very young Holly. And then it was like we had the pro wrestling and the kickboxers and the boxers and jiu-jitsu, and I thought, and y'all are putting us on top of all these people that are going to be kicking the crap out of everybody. But I said, you know, Holly came around with that damn roundhouse kick, and it was like, Jesus. She's fun, and like she got Ronda out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't see it coming.
Yeah, that was a nasty kick.
I
wanted to ask. Oh, sorry. I was gonna ask. What do you think about Cyborg's exit from UFC? And do you think she's doing? Is she doing great in Bellator? Because I haven't been following her lately.
I know she had took a loss or two in Bellator. Think she's on the hot seat like she was, because you know she did test positive for you know PEDs, and when she got smaller, she's not the same, you know, the same monster she was running through everybody.
Mm.
I mean, she's been, still a good fighter, but she's just not the same.
I did want to ask you, do you think MMA should allow rash guards? Because I know it's a thing in jiu-jitsu where you have no-gi fights, and I really love the graphic design of rash guards, and I think it would be great for MMA fighters to be able to wear them in case they, you know, are subconscious or just, you know, don't want to go shirtless. And I think, do you think rash guards should be a thing in MMA?
I think it do, because when you grab hold of each other, you know, you won't be slipping, because when you get sturdy, you slip off of each other. And like you said, a lot of people are body conscious about their appearance. So, you know, that's one thing, you know, that I see it having a good advantage. But the UFC, they actually came up with that shirtless look from, you know,
right.
They got that from Bruce Lee, Enter the Dragon, when, you know, he did the MMA scene at the beginning of the movie. So they were trying to that same that look, but people being body conscious about their, you know, their lower body and, you know, private areas. That's why they gave the guys when, you know, short or spandex short, same for the women. But they was leaning more towards that look. But I think the rash guard would be a good idea because, you know, say if you get somebody in an arm bar and you lean back, you can see it and you can just go ahead and stop the fight. Where without a shirt, if you grab that arm and you apply it and you might be slipping and they don't tap, and when you finally do apply it, the arm is broke. So I think the rash guard would be a good idea.
Yeah, I think it'd be great for advertising too, because if you know, UFC obviously has Venom, and I think they're putting out crypto shirts or rash guards, but I guess for other training, but or for advertising, I think it'd be great, like because you know Brock Lesnar, he works WWE with these shorts, and he'll wear like Jimmy John, so it'd be kind of cool to give the fighters some. Something to wear, like rash guards, to either advertise the UFC sponsors or get their own sponsors, if, you know, if that was able to be done.
Yeah, it would be a whole different look, and it would look good. But the only thing about that, MMA is like much like the fitness industry and gyms. Everything has become what I call sexualized. In order to make money. And what I mean by that is, like, say, back in the 60s and 70s, when people went to a gym, it was all about health and fitness, getting stronger, trying to get toned, trying to get muscular, whether you're a man or a woman. So, yeah, they wore leggings, and the guys was wearing, you know, the tank tops back then. But when the 80s came around, it became so sexualized. You got guys in the gym now walking around with the shirts off, wearing Speedos, or you got women, you know, with the see-through leggings, or wearing, some gyms I've seen, they wear thongs in the gym when they work out. I mean, no disrespect at all. It just, you know, that's what I've seen in gyms, you know, and fitness industries and the muscle magazines. So the reason why they did that was to bring in more revenue, to bring in more money, because, you know, in Hollywood, like they say, set sales. That's why every time you look at a movie poster or a trailer, you're either going to have the shirtless man, or you're going to have the woman in the bikini, or, you know, showing the back end, or, you know, something. So UFC, that's what they did. They
do you Oh, sorry. That is a good point. Body showing more skin and showing more toned figures probably does sell the sport more. Quickly, I wanted to get, do you have any thoughts on Matt Riddle? He was a former UFC fighter, and he's kind of had some success in WWE, NXT main roster.
Yeah. What do I think about him?
Yeah. Do you think he's a great fighter, great pro wrestler?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I like Riddle. You know, I like his technique, especially, you know, I can see it in his, when he's in the ring. I can see he has a lot of, like, kickboxing, Muay Thai techniques that he used. Very good kicks. And, you know, from what I understand, he's a real down-to-earth person. And I could tell he's a fighter. I actually looked at some of his old matches before he even got in wrestling, and he's pretty decent. So, I think
sorry to cut you off, but I did want to ask you, how many jiu-jitsu competitions have you done and have won? Because I did want to ask you about that, because next competition in my area is January, so I'm wondering what your record is in competitions and what you can do to succeed. Do you go for points more? Do you go for submissions?
I won six matches. I lost one, and that one I lost, that was my fault because I stayed on my back too long. Mostly in my division, if the guy's not bigger than me, he may be stronger than me. So I mostly try to move around a lot to try to tire him out, because if he's a big guy and he's very strong, I don't try to muscle him and try to go head-to-head with him. You know, the main thing I try to do is stay on top. And if I get on top, I try to stay there, never try to get on the bottom. Because once you get on the bottom, not saying that you can't win or escape, but on the bottom, it depends on how skilled your opponent is. They can put a lot of pressure on you, and it's not comfortable being on the bottom. And the longer you're there, the more points they score. So my advice
would be to get top.
All right, I tell you what, Steve and Sinister and Susan, we got 90 seconds left, so I'm going to have to say thank you to everybody for being on this show. It was a lot of fun.
Sinister.
Hey, Sinister, would you come back?
Please, please plug whatever you have to plug and mention the school too and where that is.
Okay, me?
Yeah.
Okay, my school is Warrior Jiu-Jitsu. It's in Grovetown, Georgia, and my instructor name is Bobby Wilk, and he's very good. He's actually held a title in kickboxing, a world title in kickboxing heavyweight division. And he's a third-degree jiu-jitsu master also. And our professor is Gustavo Machado. He's up in Virginia Beach. And he's also fifth-degree Naidan in jiu-jitsu.
Wow, that's great. Susan Green, what have you got to say to us as we head on into the sunset tonight?
Well, whenever LLR lets me open up my gym again, I'll be training. I've got three new guys that are wanting, I guess they're kind of chomping at the bit to start training, but LLR released me because of COVID.
Well, we can't
walk
wait
out whenever
till
they
you
caught
do.
Me out there training.
And Sinister, Sinister, thank you so much. We hope you'll be back as a panelist next week. And Stellar Steven, the professor of wrestling, we're so glad you were here with us. And I want to say good night to everybody from Pro Wrestling Interviews, sponsored by Transamerica. And we're just glad to have everybody with us. And we'll see every one of you next week, 9 p.m. Eastern. Mm-hmm. Take care, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Bye, guys.
Shout out to Apex.